You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. Welcome back to part two of my interview with the legendary case officer, George Cave. We will pick up right where we left off in part one. George, that was a very interesting time when you were in Tehran, and as you know well, the revolution would come again, another revolution in 79, when they raided the American embassy and held many of our folks hostage. Could you see when you were there sort of the seeds of that, what might come down the track? Did you sense that? Because the American intelligence community and the government took a lot of hits for sort of not foreseeing that, not understanding what was going on in Iran. What was your sense?
It's extremely difficult for governments to change policies.
That's the policy, but could you see, but yes. It's another thing to intelligence.
In 1975, I wrote for Dick Helms had asked me to write a long aerogram about the changes in Iran. And by 1975, I had concluded that Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was going to be the last Shah of Iran. That something, you can't predict revolutions, but something was going to happen because when they had the freewheeling elections the Shah was going to allow in 1975, people for the first time became very politically active. I knew a lot of the organizers in the Iran Noeen Party, which was Hoveyda's party, and they were very enthusiastic. The population was very enthusiastic because they're going to be able to vote for the leadership. According to the Shah's dicta, the party that won the election, the head of the party would become prime minister after the British model. So what happened was is that General Nasiri, the head of SAVAK, and I guess it was a Muzigar, Jamshid Muzigar, who was the Minister of Interior at the time, went to the Shah and said, look, we've just done a survey. If you allow free elections, the Iran Noeen party is going to get over 80% of the vote. And the Shah sort of mumbled and said, well, could you make it 60-40? And they said, not without it being apparent that it's being rigged. So, and then Nasiri told the Shah that, look, Your Majesty, if you allow these elections to go the way it's now set up, you will be the first Shah in 2,500 years that didn't decide on who was prime minister. And I think that did it. The Shah canceled the elections, dissolved the two political parties, and created the Rastakhiz party with himself as the head of the party.
And so, in fact, the government had a very good sense of the thinkings and feelings of the people, of the electorate, if you will. Did we, the government, the intelligence community, did we also understand that?
I think we were in the difficult position of telling the U.S. government something it didn't want to hear.
That's our job.
I know. Well, Dick Helms sent in my dispatch, or my airgram. But who reads airgrams? It was 26 pages. And I can lie, in a concluded statement, he says, I just said that either an individual or an idea or a group is going to end up taking over.
So we, in effect, as a government, turned a deaf ear and eye, if you will, to what was happening.
Well, look at Jimmy Carter's visit to Tehran at the end of 1977, where he gave this incredible speech. Incidentally, that speech, whether Carter might not like it, but that was one of the reasons why the hostages were kept beyond the election in 1980.
Why? So, why was that?
Because he so despised Carter that when he was told after the election they were going to release, you know, when Reagan was, and then someone told Khomeini, well, you know, Carter's still president. You know, and so Khomeini said, as long as Carter's president, we'll hold the hostages.
Interesting. George, let me move forward a bit. You were eventually, after that stint, made chief of station in Jeddah, capital of in Saudi Arabia. Yes. And you served in that post for a couple of years until you were eventually PNG, that is declared persona non grata, which is in effect being declared not welcome in the country. But that's very unusual for that to have happened in Saudi Arabia, which has essentially been an ally of the United States and a country with whom we've had good relations. How did that happen?
Well, I actually belong to a very exclusive club. There's only two other American officials who were ever declared persona non grata from Saudi Arabia. I don't know if since my declaration whether there's been anyone else, but I haven't heard of any. What happened is that Jimmy Carter was putting enormous pressure on the Saudis to join him in a Middle East peace. He felt that he needed something like that if he was going to be reelected. He needed some big success. I took it upon myself to write a private message to the director asking him to meet with the president and explain several different points, because some of the senior Saudis were questioning, based on the pressure being put on them, to go along with Carter's hope for a general Middle East peace. They were afraid that, they were certain that they couldn't do that. They couldn't get out. They were prepared to do things behind the scenes, but they couldn't openly support a Middle East peace. And of course, they were very opposed to a separate peace between Israel and Egypt. In fact, they broke off relations with Egypt as a result of that. And the problem was, I sent my comments in on a Saturday morning, and then I read them on the front page of the International Herald Tribune the following Friday. They had been leaked. Part of the problem, I gather, was that by this time, President Carter, was not really paying much attention to the intelligence community. Particularly, the admiral had difficulty in seeing him, so that he put my message in the president's daily brief, and that's how he got my comments to the president. And that was obviously leaked to the press since it appeared in the International Herald Tribune. It's almost word for word.
And so were you identified by name?
No. You can't do that because of FISA.
Right. But it was clear where it was from, and so as a result of which you were no longer welcome.
I think I was referred to as the chief U.S. intelligence officer in Saudi Arabia.
So you were no longer welcome in the kingdom.
Well, they gave me a week to get out. George, let my wife and kids stay until the kids finish school.
Well, that was generous. Let me ask you, George. Let's move forward to something which has commanded a tremendous amount of interest in our country, both by just people, not just historians, but people following public events in a very sort of major way, you know, the major developments in our country. And one of the major developments in our country was the Iran-Contra issue, for which, as you know, we had a president who was brought in and asked to testify about what he remembered or didn't remember and so forth. Could you just give us your perspective on Iran-Contra?
How many hours have you got?
Well, we have a limited amount of time, and I realize part of it is how you got brought into Iran-Contra, because we are talking to you. How you brought into Iran-Contra and your perspective at the time and now looking back.
Well, the agency, particularly in the person of Casey, did not want to rely on the translations of Ghorbanifar and Albert Hakim. So as soon as I was mentioned to Casey, they said, fine, bring him in. And this was on March the 5th. And for the first time, I learned that the U.S. government is dealing with Ghorbanifar, whom I had terminated in 1980.
Ghorbanifar, could you just a word or two on who he was?
Ghorbanifar is a very successful Iranian businessman and who has been a major factor in the gray arms business, gray and black arms business.
Yes.
And at this meeting, Casey, and there was Tom Twain, there was several other people. Ollie North was there, Charlie Allen. And
Charlie Allen was then a senior CIA officer.
Senior
Oliver
CIA.
North, of course, was a retired Marine officer then
the
working
time,
in the
Charlie
National Security Council.
Charlie Allen was the deputy chief of CTC.
Yeah, of the counterintelligence.
The counterterrorist.
Center. The counterterrorism center, right.
And I objected pretty strenuously, saying that, A, you can't trust Ghorbanifar, and B, the Israelis have a different view of this than we do. The meeting dispersed, and I went down to my office, and I called Casey's secretary and said, I've got to see him. So I went up, and privately expressed serious doubts about the wisdom of Ghorbanifar using him, because you can't. He's totally, the most totally amoral person I ever met, and also that I was leery of a major role being played by an Israeli in the person of Amiram Nir. Casey said, look, George, sometimes, you know, with regard to Ghorbanifar, he said, sometimes we have to deal with people like that because of the situation. And I thought to myself, yeah, you're thinking of OSS times, where if the guy didn't do what you told him to do, you take him out and shoot him. So anyway, he said, look, George, do your best to make it work. I did tell him I thought it was a good idea that we're talking to the Iranians. So Twetton and North and I.
Tom Twetton then was?
Chief of the NE division.
Of NE division. Mm-hmm.
And we flew to Paris the following day to meet with Ghorbanifar and Nir. and begin the setup for a visit to Tehran. Over the next couple of weeks, there were some contacts, and one of the proposals was for North and I to fly in with Ghorbanifar and have meetings with Iranians to set an agenda for a meeting with a senior U.S. official. And we were going to go in April. But Admiral Poindexter ruled that out, saying it was too dangerous.
He was then the National Security Counselor.
Yeah, head of the National Security Council. And I couldn't, you know, if it was too dangerous for the two of us to go in, you know, why was it not dangerous for six of us to go in May?
George, just if I may ask you, what was the purpose of your going? To offer them some intelligence support? I mean, had it reached the point where we were looking at the so-called arms for hostages trade, or was it a very early stage of that?
We'd already supplied the Iranians, the Israelis in September of 1985 had sent in 500 TOW missiles, and then we in February sent in 1,000 TOW missiles. So, and we also sent in 18. I can't remember the name of them. Surface-to-air missiles.
Stingers?
Hawks, yeah, Hawks.
But the purpose of your going to, if you had gone with Ghorbanifar, what was the purpose of that visit?
The purpose was to have an initial meeting with the Iranians.
Okay.
And come up with an agenda that both the Iranians and we agreed upon, and then it would be followed by the McFarland visit. So that was ruled out. I was in constant phone conversation with the guy that was the deputy, was one of the deputies in their security organization, and we finally agreed to go in, and everyone was all set. What they did is General Secord rented a 707 and had it flown to Iceland, and we used the tail markings for that plane to go to Tehran. What we did is North went ahead to Tel Aviv, and McFarland and I and two communicators flew to Manstein, and then we took an agency 707, flew it to Tel Aviv, and we were met at the plane, and we were taken to the basement of a hotel, given room keys, and then we were black the whole time. So
black meaning you were totally unidentified, no showing.
We had nothing to do with the American embassy,
right,
or anything else. So they said to relax, and then Nir took us to dinner out on a pier, a very nice dinner. And the following day, we were told to, at a certain time, there would be a woman sitting at a desk in the foyer of a hotel. Just give her the keys and go down in the basement, and we'll pick you up. And they took us out, and they had a black 707, and we used the call numbers for the one that was sitting in Iceland to fly to Tehran. It was an 11-hour trip because we had to appear to be coming from Mombasa. That was the drill. Apparently, the word hadn't gotten out to the Iranian military, because when we entered Iranian airspace, they threatened to shoot us down. And I got on, you know, in Farsi explaining who they should contact in the Prime Minister's office, because they are aware of the fact that we're coming and we're bringing well-needed things for your war effort. So then North busted in. He couldn't understand what I was saying in Farsi, so he busted in and said, "This plane is flying to Iran on the order of the President of the United States." I suppose that was intercepted by every... But in any case, we didn't get shot down. We went to Tehran. As I mentioned to you before, we sat in the airport for 2.5 hours until they came and picked us up. And we went to the top floor of the Hilton Hotel, which they had cleared out, and we were the only ones there. So that afternoon, a very young Iranian came by who was from the Prime Minister's office, he said, and we sat there for about an hour and a half listening to him rant and rave about all the sins America had committed during the past century or more. And he left. So we staged a kind of a play on a supposed source, Russian source of ours, named Vladimir. And North started it by asking me, we talked about what this young guy had said, and then
you staged this
we staged the...
You assumed the room was...
It was. The LP was on the same floor. What had happened is that Kangerlu, who had met us and taken us to the hotel, knocked on a door there, and a guy came out, and everything was black in the room. And he said, "Now, if you need anything, just knock on this door, and someone will come out and get what you want, or order dinner, or what have you." So we started talking about Vladimir. Now, the Soviets do a practice invasion of Iran. You know, it's one of these things, it's mainly communications and alerting people, and sort of just like they do it about every two or they've done it about every 2 or 3 years. And so what we talked about is, you know, North asking me, was there anything new from Vladimir before you left? And I went into a song and dance about Vladimir reporting that there was some concern in the Central Committee about what was going on in Iran, things like that. And they were, the Russians were very alert to what was proceeding in Iran and very concerned about certain things, with not much in the way of specifics. Well, the next day, you know, well, that night we were standing out, North and I and Bud McFarland was standing out on the balcony of the hotel, and both North and McFarland were concerned about the tone of the afternoon's lecture by this young Iranian. And I said, "They're just putting down a bargaining point, and I think things will be much better tomorrow." And they were. The Iranians told me in the hall, as an aside, he said, "Look, we're having a problem. We're sending someone to Lebanon now to negotiate with the hostage holders." And I said, "Well, why did you wait so long?" And they said, "We really didn't think you'd come." And so, you know, he said, "We're going to need time." Well, the formal negotiations didn't go very well. And these Iranians, some people on the Iranian side would, you know, come up to me in the hall and ask, you know, can we try this or that or whatever. And finally McFarland said, "I don't want you talking to these people outside of an official thing." And I said, "Well, you're not going to get much done officially. The Iranians like to negotiate poshte perde vaziri miz, which means behind the curtain and under the table." But in any case, things weren't bad. same way, you know, the following day. But we didn't make much progress, and no hostages were getting released. So late in the evening, actually, it was early the next morning, like I think it was the 28th of May, the most senior guy we were negotiating came to me, and he said, look, can you get me in to see McFarlane? And I said, sure. And I did, and he came in, and he said, look, if we can get one hostage, we're trying to get two, but if we get one, would you send in the spare parts and the TOW missiles that you've got in Israel? And McFarlane agreed. And after this official left, McFarlane said to me, okay, if there's no hostages released, we're leaving tomorrow morning. And he called the pilot of the plane, and he said, get everything ready. We're probably leaving tomorrow morning early. And the pilot says, we got a problem. And McFarlane said, what's the problem? He said, we need fuel. And so McFarlane turned to me and said, George, get the plane refueled. So I went down and knocked on the door. And the guy came out, and we got the plane refueled. I will go to my deathbed, to my grave, without ever saying how I got the plane refueled.
Let me just ask you one question. You mentioned this staged conversation that you had, and you referred to Vladimir, who was supposedly a general, a Soviet general. What was the purpose of staging that conversation, which you assumed would be bugged or taped or overheard? And what is it you were trying to convey?
Well, the purpose of what North wanted to convey was the fact that the Soviets were worried, and that we did in the intelligence brief point out that they had very recently staged this invasion of Iran, practice invasion of Iran. And we also showed them some stuff about the troops that were within just a few miles of the Iranian border. There was even some, I think, commercial satellite photography. So the next morning, though, what was interesting is everyone is sort of getting breakfast, and Kangerloo comes running into the hotel, and I'm there, and he said, get everything ready, we got to get out immediately. So I got everyone ready and out, and we went down, and they had these beat-up old cars out in the front of the hotel, and I got into the first car with Kangerloo, and we roared out of the hotel and immediately went on back roads. Instead of, there's a main road, you know, that goes, no traffic lights, and it goes right down to the road that leads out to the airport. Instead, we went down all these back streets that most of which I knew fairly well. And then when we got to the airport, we were on the military side. And of course, the plane had been refueled. And one of the guys I was talking to, who was a Rev Guard and was the guy we briefed on Soviet intentions, stayed with, I was at the foot of the gangway going into the plane, and I was talking to him, and he was insisting that we maintain contact. And I said, okay, but for the time being, we'll have to do it through Gorbanifar. So then McFarlane came out of the door and yelled at me to come up and get on the plane. We were leaving, so we left.
But was the, again, going back to the conversation on the imaginary Vladimir, were you trying to heighten the Iranians' concerns about Soviet
Soviet intentions.
Designs on Iran.
Soviet intentions and designs on Iran.
Invasion plan.
And that fit in with the briefing we gave them.
Okay, so that matched the briefing. I hope you enjoyed the second part of my talk with George Cave. Come back soon for the third and final part of our discussion.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum, that's one word, .org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you.